Precognitive
Dissonance. Welcome aboard, everybody. This is your host, Miles Lewis, and
Greg York.
And you're listening to Anomaly Radio. This is the show Precognitive Dissonance. Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you have heard us before and are coming back for more. It's a great, beautiful, somewhat beautiful day here in Austin, Texas, and we're happy to be alive.
Ah, damn glad to be alive.
I am too.
Gorgeous day. Traffic wasn't nearly as bad getting here as I feared it would be.
I guess maybe I over-dramatized how bad it was.
Well, you hate traffic, and I'm only mildly disgruntled by it. And, you know, it's one of those things. We've both lived in Austin long enough to have seen it go from a place with, you know, a 15-minute rush hour to a rush hour.
Rush. And I'm the one usually rushing, so that's why I get so impatient with traffic.
But we've got a wonderful show for you tonight. Unrehearsed, as always.
Unrehearsed, yes.
And all over the map. Starting with, where would you like to start?
I'm not sure where to start, but we might as well just tell them we got some cryptozoology, we've got some ufology, and,
the dovetail into parapolitics.
Ooh, that could be interesting. And some, maybe a dose of parageology.
Oh, okay.
Well, whatever the hell that might be, I don't know.
Geological anomalies are always, well, I was about to say always fascinating, and the fact of the matter is they're probably one of the driest subjects out there, but they're part of the community. And I'll put in a brief plug here for probably the premier anomalous of our time, Mr. William Corliss, who for, better than 30 years has been heading up something called the Sourcebook Project.
Very noble effort.
And you can look up his work online at sciencefrontiers.com, where the newsletter, Science Frontiers, is archived back to, I believe, 1977.
It's old. Almost as old as me.
But not quite as old as yours truly. And that's all we're going to say on that particular anomaly.
You're very young at heart, Craig.
Ah.
And you wear your heart on your sleeve. And what other cliche aphorism?
I don't know. I just wish we had a ba-dum-thump sound effect. We'll be here all week. Try the veal.
So you were alluding earlier to me about the controversial case in cryptozoology that many a cryptozoologist has spoken out on, but most of whom have followed the lead of Lauren Coleman.
Ah, yeah, we got this off the web earlier this week. Lauren Coleman and El Mono Grande, the big one. I assume that's what it means in Spanish. I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth.
Nor am I.
But it deals with what is probably one of the 10 most recognizable icons in cryptozoology, the Deloy's ape photograph. For those of you who are searching your memory, if you ever saw a picture of what looked like a spider monkey, a rather rangy anthropoid, propped up on top of a small crate with a stick under its neck to hold its head up.
Kind of a macabre picture, actually.
Yeah. In keeping with 19th century death photographs, you remember the wonderful scene at the end of The Others. Maybe you don't.
I don't.
Okay, well, that's a tangent we won't hair off on.
Dead monkey.
But
that funky monkey.
The exciting thing to me about this recent article, and I've only had a chance to just page through the Coleman article just a few minutes before the start of the show, But the image that you generally see, and the image that I first remember seeing in Bernard Hubbleman's On the Track of Unknown Animals, is a very cropped photograph where the image of the ape or the monkey fills the entire frame. The photo that was published on a blog, UCM Guy, at The Hive, which I believe is the blog space for the Modesto Bee, was it?
Yeah, that's it's the URL's at the bottom of the page there.
Ah, yes. Thehive.modbee.com.
Modesto.
Anyway, the photograph published in this blog, there's considerably more background to it, and there's also, it looks like it's on the bank of a river or a slough of some kind, and the image is the same, but there's a little bit more of a sense of scale to it. And the thing is, I ran across references to the Coleman article a year or so back, and Coleman's brief is essentially that, in addition to Ivan Sanderson's doubts about it, it's in this one.
Couldn't find it.
Ah, and the Coleman article also uses the crop photograph. The Coleman article basically takes up some of Ivan Sanderson's doubts about the creature, asserting that it might be an outsized spider monkey, which, you know, from my limited knowledge of anthropology and primatology, there we go. From my limited knowledge of primatology, sure, could be. I noticed one passage where Coleman quotes Sanderson as talking about the white patch on the creature's forehead as being typical of a particular species of South American spider monkey. And Sanderson, though he was certainly given to hopeful optimism on some subjects.
How big was that penguin?
15, 16 feet tall. Though he was given to hopeful optimism on some topics, was also a trained field zoologist, and I think in this instance, you know, his reservations can be taken with in good faith. But it's the end of the article where Coleman talks about a possible scurrilous motive for the promotion of the photograph. Apparently, Deloise, the organizer of the expedition on which the photograph was taken, didn't really consider it terribly important. But towards the end of the article, Coleman comments on an acquaintance or friend of Deloise, who was the proponent of a fairly obscure evolutionary theory, which posited that the various races of mankind had descended from separate and distinct branches of the primate family.
So for gorillas and orangutans and other types of primates, these were supposed to be the originators of
the
each.
The root stock of each.
Root races.
Yeah. I think in the blog article it comments that whites were supposed to be descended from Homo sapiens or Cro-Magnons, sorry. Blacks and Indians from the gorilla and the orangutan. And this ape, this unknown primate, would have been the root race for the red races of the Americas.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. That's what it says.
A thoroughly, you know, and, you know, just for the record, a since thoroughly discredited theory.
Okay. It basically says that Montandon was a polygenist who believed that human races evolved from different species of primates, as Coleman and Reinel write. It was important to his view of the world that he understood the white issued from archaic Homo sapiens, Cro-Magnon, the yellow from the orangutan, and black from the gorilla of the or the chimpanzee. And the discovery of the Amaranthropoid explained the origin of the American Indian, the so-called red race. Well, I read this article on Lauren Coleman and El Mono Grande, and it's basically just largely just criticizing he and his co-writer for that anomalous article for just not really presenting any evidence other than, okay, we've got this hearsay that this person's motives might have been less than, well, or would have been tainted by their ethnic, racial biases and bigotry, and that I guess the way I had always interpreted their argument was that it was actually being used, it was a deliberate hoax to perpetuate that idea. But that seems a little different than just somebody who has maybe some politically incorrect ideas or some non-scientifically accepted ideas who was thinking they were actually practicing science,
yeah,
but in fact may have been serving larger
and, you know, it's,
agendas.
It's one of those, this is a case I knew about for years. Like I said, I was only recently, and it occurs to me now that it's only been in the last 6 to 8 months that I became aware of, you know, there being any kind of racist subtext for the photograph and its subsequent promotion. But let's hear what
Lauren Coleman and
Michael Reynal, R-E-Y-N-A-L, is his co-author. Shoemaker and others have put forth the case that this photograph must be taken seriously. The photo is seen as a demonstration of the body of folklore that exists on apes in the green hell of South America. Yes, there is a large body of reports and sightings of anthropoids in South America, and that is not a dispute here. But what we are calling for instead is a final dismissal of the Deloise photograph based upon some rather simple facts. First, the animal in the photograph looks like a spider monkey and probably is. Ivan T. Sanderson realized this long ago. And it goes on to detail what Sanderson's criticisms of the photographs are. First, this picture, this is quoting from Sanderson, first, this picture produced by Dr. Francis Deloy is obviously that of the spider monkey, which is a very distinct type of South American primate that may be seen in any zoo. It displays all the characteristics of that genus, narrow shoulders and pinched chest, comparative lengths of upper and lower arms and legs, hands and feet in detail, and the enlarged clitoris of a female. In fact, it is a pretty clear picture of one of those animals dead. End quote. Then Sanderson goes into the technicalities of how to determine the height of this semi-tall spider monkey and concludes, quote, thus, this animal, with its head poked up to an unnatural degree by a stick, measures about 27 inches, it measuring 10 by 6x as against the box. This is a fair-sized spider monkey, but not even a large one. The original photograph is not just a case of mistaken identity, it is an outright hoax, and a noxious one at that, being a deliberate deception.
So what does it say about that clitoris?
That is characteristic of female spider monkeys.
Okay, because one of the things I was going to point out, looking at the picture there, the picture that's reproduced in The Anomalist, which issue of The Anomalist is this, by the way?
This is The Anomalist number 4.
Oh, yes. A very,
Wired Spirits.
Very good issue, as they all are, but that one in particular I really liked. what do you see different about the clitoris in this picture?
That is interesting. Either as a result of the way it's been reproduced, or this
the picture in the Anomalist is cropped. The contrast is a lot higher, and looks almost like a more Xeroxed type of an image,
mm-hmm.
whereas the image that's online is appears to be a much broader view of the scene with, as you said, a river behind, and the a much better resolution. And this is at thehive.modb.com. That's modbee.com. Lauren Coleman and El Mono Grande is the title. But the thing I bring up the clitoris because in the picture that's online, it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's yeah. It looks like a penis. Actually, what I thought it was it looks like the funnel shaped sheath that you see certain types of tribesmen wearing over their yayas. And so it occurs to me that if that wasn't a normal feature in spider monkeys, that would, to me, indicate a more plausible hoax, in that maybe they went to the trouble of fastening a fake codpiece, so to speak, over what they would then be reporting as a male.
And I can't wait for that to start cropping up on the Internet.
Cropping?
Go.
But the other thing I noticed is that I thought that the feet were both touching the ground, but clearly its left foot is hovering above the ground, and there's a shadow cast underneath it.
Well, the conclusion of the Coleman Reynal article, subtitled Framework of Shame, so with Montadon's racism lies the death of another cryptozoological legend. Although so many people, quote, wish to believe, unquote, in this photograph, it is time to put this case finally to rest. As Sir Arthur Keith said about the picture when he saw it in 1929, a photograph of the animal from behind would have clinched matters. Ask yourself why that wasn't done. If the phenomenal thing about this animal was that it was an ape and thus tailless, why no picture of its backside?
That's a good point.
Well, it is a good point, but again, it's asking to prove a negative. The subsequent history of the carcass itself, and we should probably back up and describe the circumstances under which the photographs were taken. This was an expedition to, I believe, the Mato Grosso in 1919 or 1920. It was a pair of creatures that approached the party, evidently screaming and hurling feces, which is fairly classic primate behavior. they were obviously sufficiently large enough to be threatening, so shots were fired. One of the animals was killed, the other fled, and it was the animal that was killed that was propped up. Now, obviously, the creature was not afforded great importance because no portion of its anatomy was preserved except apparently the skull, which the expedition cook used as a salt cellar until it fell apart.
Oh my God, I've never heard any of that.
Yeah, it's, I believe it's in the Coleman article. So, again, it's one of those, you have a situation where the members of the expedition themselves clearly did not find it all that significant. Whether this was an instance of, well, it's a big monkey, and they all had bushmeat stew for dinner that night, or, you know, the circumstances. The other famous case from South America where we don't even have a photograph, Percy Fawcett's giant anaconda. Again, you know, we have a fairly clear document of the event and a fairly solid estimate of the length of the creature, which was about 60-some-odd feet, but the circumstances, the heat, the humidity, the weight of the creature, and the packing capabilities of the expedition, you know, pretty much precluded carting out any part of the animal. Yes, no, I don't know.
Well, you know, if these guys ate this spider monkey, believing that it represented, you know, the missing link for any of the other species. There's some pretty weird ethical quandaries there.
And then, you know, that's the thing, is that Coleman in his article points out that Delois himself did not accord any special significance to the photograph. It languished in his collections for 10 years until this Montedon fellow saw it and seized on it.
Oh, okay.
So basically, you know, you have to ask yourself, if it was a hoax, if it was just an ordinary spider monkey, why didn't Delois himself trumpet it as soon as the expedition returned? You know, it's a minor mystery. And as I started to say, until recently, I had come to regard it as interesting, but kind of unlikely, since, you know, as far as I know, no comparable sightings have cropped up of a creature answering this description. So, for me, it's one of those interesting, not strongly supported, but certainly worthy of further investigation. You know, and it should, I think the author of the UMC blog makes a good point. There's no solid evidence for a hoax.
Though, I guess the intentions of Montedon, who's the one who seized upon it, seem to be the crux of whether it's a hoax. Yeah. You know, it doesn't seem like Delois, from what you've described, was likely the one doing any hoaxing. I mean, if he wasn't making any extraordinary claims, then I don't see really the evidence for a hoax on his part. But what somebody does with that photograph afterwards is a completely different situation. So, well,
man,
there's a lot. I just would like to say there's a lot better evidence of a missing link type Bigfoot primates out there than the Delois photograph. So, and the other most the most famous photographic evidence of Patty in the Patterson-Gimlin film still stands tall in that regard.
And swaying beautifully. Oh, God. Sorry, I've read too many Robert Crumb Bigfoot stories. And that's something we're never going to bring up again. Anyway, on to the other side of the Pacific. And Megamoggies.
You pointed out this article. Actually, I had seen this article. Lithgow Megacat footage goes live from scienceblogs.com, the blog Tetrapodzoology.
Tetrapodzoology, fairly recent cryptozoology blog. The author is, I won't say a thoroughgoing skeptic, but he's definitely very solidly grounded in the sciences. And his blogs tend to be uniformly interesting. This one is fascinating and mundane at the same time. What's been happening in Australia is, for some years now, reports have been coming of people seeing what look for all the world like essentially lynx or bobcat-sized Felis domesticus, regular house cats, close to the size of pumas in some instances.
Okay, I didn't have the chance to really look into what this hubbub was about, and as I was scrolling down the blog page, I saw what looked to me like a regular house cat of enormous size hanging by its tied-up feet with some kind of trauma to its face. I was a little disturbed by the image because I thought, oh, poor putty cat. It looks like a house cat, only it looks really big. And I wasn't sure what to make of that. I didn't get the chance to read deeper. I didn't realize that's the megafauna connection.
And, yeah, that's when we were talking about this earlier today, I said I wanted to rant about, you know, its possible implications for megafauna. Megafauna is kind of a catch-all term for essentially animals bigger than the domestic norm. The last great age of megafauna ended about 10,000 years ago, the close of the last ice age, when we lost the mammoths, the great woolly rhinos, the bacteriums, and a host of other large animals, the Irish elk, that, you know, there are some trends in, I don't know, sociology, anthropology, anthroposociology, that assert that it was, in fact, us that killed them. My all-time personal favorite, the great pteranodon, Argentavis magnificens, the great bird of Argentina, which is essentially a vulture-like beak bird with a wingspan of 25 feet.
Is this the... There's a famous photograph of the silhouette of one of these things?
That's the one.
Okay, that's an amazing picture. I only recently saw that in the last couple of years and was blown away at how big this thing is.
I was. I kept the original newspaper article from the Minneapolis Tribune when the fossils were first found back in the late 70s, early 80s. Hung on to it for years. But anyway, what I was talking about in terms of, you know, this to me is just fascinating and tremendously exciting for its implications for evolutionary biology and zoology generally. Like I said, you know, for the most part, the megafauna have died off. There are supposedly virtually no big cats left in North America. And no non-imported, shall we say, major predators anywhere in the Australian continent. Since the supposed extinction of the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger, Tasmanian tiger or Tasmanian wolf, I can never remember.
I think it's tiger because it certainly looks more tiger-like with the stripes. Yeah.
Well, it's always looked like a striped greyhound with a bad disposition to me. But
yeah, almost like a badger's face. Really long snout and scraggly teeth is the image that pops into my head.
But anyway, the thing is, these evolutionary niches are currently unoccupied. And you're familiar with the theory of punctuated equilibrium in evolutionary biology?
Yeah.
It might very well be that here we're seeing, you know, a perfect example of it, where essentially the domestic cat, for whatever reason, feral populations are, you know, starting, giganticism is starting to appear in them, simply because, well, there's space to be filled. I mean, this may be kind of loopy on the evolutionary end of things, but on the other side of the world, you've heard me talk a time or two about the implications for alligators in the Everglades of the burgeoning population of Burmese pythons, which are cropping up from, you know, essentially irresponsible pet owners releasing them in the wild and having them reach their full growth and compete actively with the only other apex predator in the area, which is the American alligator.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I remember you talking about that.
Yeah. So, you know, that, and, you know, I freely admit there is a streak of the sci-fi Saturday Godzilla movie matinee.
It's got to be atomic energy.
In all of this, you know.
Well, just all the depleted uranium spreading around the world.
The prospect of 80 feet of angry gator rampaging through the streets of Miami just brings a thrill to my heart,
Alligator. Alligators in the sewers. Has anybody applied the idea of megafauna to Bigfoot? It just occurs to me. What if, gigantism in Homo erectus?
It's an interesting notion. The problem Bigfoot, especially, and I like the term Bigfoot, by the way.
You don't like Sasquatch?
Sasquatch is okay, too. There was something in the Crypto Mundo log today about 1958 and the Ray Parker.
That, I think that sounds about right.
Man revealed to have been responsible for hoaxing an awful lot of Bigfoot footprints. And the author of the blog entry proposed yet another name for Bigfoot. I can't for the life of me remember what it is at the moment. But, yeah, that's... Well, anyway, the...
Megafauna and Bigfoot.
The... if Bigfoot is a real ape, you know, and not... a psychosocial or ultra-terrestrial phenomena. If Bigfoot is a real ape, the most likely fossil candidate is either Giganthropus, I think, or I want to say Meganthropus, which was a related ape. The problem with it is that there's no fossil record of them in North America. The fossil record that we do have is primarily from China and Malaysia. That's where Meganthropus, which was supposed to reach a height of about 8 feet, Giganthropus, it's speculated, could have reached as much as 12 feet.
Damn.
But the problem with both of these is that the fossil record for both animals is incredibly scanty. Virtually all we have are teeth and fragments of jaws, which is interesting all by itself. And it also leaves open the possibility that these creatures could have migrated across the Bering Land Bridge. Who knows, fleeing the encroachment of Homo sapiens? But they would certainly occupy a megafaunal niche. They were... Giganthropus, I believe, is almost certainly... is supposed to have been almost completely herbivorous and a fairly specialized diet, like the panda, that would have consisted almost entirely of bamboo.
That would have left it pretty hungry.
Well, and that's, you know, one of those... because we have so little fossil record, you know, all that you can speculate is on where from the teeth. But, you know, but the notion of it actually being a remnant hominid population that has somehow evolved in the wild, it's interesting. You know. But, you know, as with everything Bigfoot, Sasquatch related, you know, we await a a specimen to examine.
A carcass.
I want the Bigfoot fur rug for my living room. Did I say that out of the air?
Yeah, we want to mount them, mount its bust above a mantelpiece, maybe.
Well,
talk.
There's mounting and mounting. One of the most surreal Bigfoot stories I ever read was called "In the Yola Bola Belly Middle Eel Wilderness," about a rather milquetoast sort of character who has a profoundly sexual encounter with a female Bigfoot in the aforementioned wilderness area, someplace in the wilds of Canada. I want to say it's a James Tiptree Jr. story, but I wouldn't swear to it.
Well, I have yet to read Lauren Coleman's latest Bigfoot book, but it apparently has a whole chapter devoted to the sexuality of Bigfoot, which apparently is, well, apparently has definitely been an off-limits area for most cryptozoologists. And the only places that sexual encounters seem to have been reported besides tabloids are in the annals of what Coleman calls Bigfoot contactees, you know, people who... describe recurring encounters with Bigfoot. And the thing that really intrigues me about his ideas about Bigfoot contactees is the propensity for them being serial killers. the two most modern examples. I can't remember both their names, but Starkweather, who actually is referenced in the fictional film The Frighteners, directed by Peter Jackson.
Mm-hmm. One of my personal favorites.
Yeah, I really like that movie. In that movie, there's a an individual who's trying to beat the record of kills established by previous mass murderers. And I said serial killers earlier, I should say really technically mass murderers. Starkweather apparently had believed to, I forget if he just was simply fascinated by the subject of cryptozoology, but I believe he actually claimed repeated sightings. I'd like to really talk about that more in the future, but maybe we'll have Lauren Coleman on soon. Actually, we're trying to schedule some interviews for this show and other shows on Anomaly Radio coming up soon. Once again, you're listening to Precognitive Dissonance, and this is the Anomaly Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. Megafauna. Megafauna burger.
Oh, I don't know, Fred.
I posted the old Winston cigarette commercials featuring the Flintstones over at AnomalyTV.com not too long ago, as well as some other politically incorrect cartoons, including lots and lots of old Bugs Bunny cartoons that I'd never been aware of that were hilarious, even if they were somewhat
tainted,
politically incorrect. But particularly the ones featuring characters like that look like Hitler, like the duck that's Hitler plays Hitler. It's hilarious. It's really really funny.
Before we get off the subject, we should say that the video referenced in the Tetrapod Zoology blog is fairly clear and fairly sharp. It has one unfortunate omission, and it's the curse of the crypto camera. The author makes mention of having seen the full version of the video in which it starts by focusing on an ordinary gray tabby cat and then pans over and you pick up what looks like another house cat, but it's clear you can see a difference in size. And, you know, estimates on this thing run, I want to say, 30, 40 centimeters at the shoulder. It really does show a monstrously large black feral cat that some people estimate to be about 1.5 meters long in total.
Damn.
That's about 5 feet.
That's a big-ass cat.
Yeah. That's not your ordinary kitty.
What's the line in The Princess Bride? Is it rats of amazing terror?
Rats of unusual size? I don't believe they exist. Rodents of unusual
Rodents.
Size.
Rodents.
What about the R-O-U-S? Yes.
Yes. Well, so some of the other thing that you pointed me at... Reanalysis of the 1965 Heflin UFO photos. The UFO iconoclasts, who are a bunch of rude upstart UFO guys who probably don't like to be called ufologists because they have great disdain for ufology. As
hard-bitten, two-fisted iconoclasts who pull no punches, have no sacred cows, and... are actually, I think, as interested in honest, serious research as anybody. Ufology, like cryptozoology, like all aspects of investigation of the paranormal, sometimes needs to be taken very, very strongly to task.
Taken down a notch.
Whopped upside the hay. We've got a couple of things that kind of dovetail with one another.
I'm not sure what the other thing is, but you pointed me to the online PDF file for this reanalysis of the 1965 Heflin UFO photos. That was it's written by veteran UFO researcher Ann Druffel, Robert M. Wood, and Eric Kelson, who I believe those two are photograph analysts. And this is a reproduction. This PDF is a reproduction of Journal of Scientific Exploration, Volume 14, Number 4, pages 583 through several other pages.
And the thing about it is, these are, again, very well-known photographs. To refresh y'all's memory, if you've ever seen a photograph of a silvery disc-shaped UFO taken from what looks like a car window overlooking a two-lane blacktop, you probably know the ones we're talking about.
Yeah, I would actually describe this as a flat-top hat.
It does look a lot like a straw boater.
Barbershop quartet guys wear.
That's it exactly. It's also almost certainly the inspiration for the flying saucer that was used in the opening the Invaders in Color.
Oh,
the Quinn Martin production. Which I've got the model kit for it, you know.
So this Heflin guy was a highway dude who was documenting bad signage. He was driving along, had his Polaroid camera in his truck, and was investigating or photographing a railroad crossing sign that was obscured by some trees, and saw a flash out of his left corner of his eye, and saw this saucer-shaped object a little ways down the road. And since he had his camera, started snapping some pictures and picked off four very, very famous pictures. Well, actually, only three of them are really very famous.
The fourth one is not of the craft itself, but of a smoke ring that was left behind as residue when the craft took off. Now, Heflin, apparently at the time, did not believe he was seeing an extraterrestrial craft. He thought he was seeing an experimental aircraft.
He was very close by a military base.
El Toro Marine Base, I believe. And
that's correct.
The photographs were published. They obviously created a sensation. They were widely disseminated. Heflin himself sought no remuneration for the photographs. He didn't try to copyright them. He didn't try to exploit them in any way, shape, or form.
And was always helpful and worked with legitimate investigators.
And, of course, the local military base said, well, no, it's not one of ours.
I thought this was pretty significant. Marines came. I'm going to get this right here. Well, Marines came, borrowed the pictures, gave them back.
Mm-hmm.
Air Force came, borrowed the pictures, gave them back. And though the Air Force's investigator said there was no signs of a hoax, Blue Book declared it a hoax because they could get similar pictures throwing a hubcap up in the air.
Yeah, I think they might have declared a probable hoax.
And then later, some people identifying themselves as being from NORAD showed up, took the pictures, and never returned them.
And proved, upon subsequent investigation, to have either no connection with NORAD whatsoever, or to have been using assumed names. Both of the final pair of photograph borrowers produced only a card type ID, no photographic ID. And there the matter rested for about 10, 12 years until the middle of the 70s, when copies of copies were subjected to early computer analysis and declared firmly to be hoaxes. One of the investigators said that there was very clear evidence of a string in one of the photographs.
And, of course, the fact that these pictures appear to be taken from the inside of the car, where, you know, there's the overhang of the window, the edge, that's, you know, classic, you know, bing, 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 alarm bell for, oh, there's probably a suspended model that, you know, the armature for the suspended object is out of sight thanks to the encroachment of the window sill.
And there the matter rested for about another 15, almost 20 years, until one day in the early 90s when Heflin, now retired and in rather poor health, received a mysterious phone call, Shades of Mothman, a female voice saying, "Have you checked your mailbox lately?" He went down to his mailbox. There was nothing in it. He came back to his home, and the phone rang again. Same caller, same message. This time, there was an unmarked envelope which contained, you guessed it, the photographs.
All three of the three in the four sequence.
Yeah. Heflin had kept the fourth photograph, by the way, and this was also another bone of contention between, I say bone of contention, this was also a sticking point for the first set of analyses of the photographs, in that the photograph of the smoke ring clearly shows a partly cloudy, somewhat overcast sky.
The weather conditions were different than the other photographs.
Which is what Heflin describes as being the weather conditions for all of the photographs. Now, the photographs taken from the window of his vehicle do seem to show a fairly uniform cloudless sky. But when these photographs were subsequently examined, much more recently, and this was the substance of the last portion of this PDF that Miles is talking about, it's a little too technical for me, but in a nutshell, the grayscale, the quality of the photographs, the tone of the lighting are consistent with lighting conditions under which the photographs were taken. You know, that is, having been taken from inside the vehicle, the film is going to react a little bit differently to the ambient light than the fourth photograph,
which
was also taken from outside of the vehicle.
Right. When the object departed, he saw the ring left in the sky, drove down the road a distance of 100, 200 yards, got out of his vehicle, photographed the ring. So it basically, with the return of his photographs and the reanalysis using more modern computer technologies, it seems to corroborate everything that he originally said. Now, you earlier mentioned when we were talking about this off-air that you found this a fairly significant in light of the other, is it the Trent photograph case?
Trent Farm cases from somewhat earlier, also depicting a somewhat different craft. And again, an instance where some have asserted they're hoaxed because the craft in question, which is a more pie plate shaped with the central antenna jutting up from the center point of the disc.
Is that the one that looks like there's a barn in the photo?
That's the one.
The edge of a barn.
Also been generating some controversy lately because a supposedly lost Trent Farm photograph surfaced on the internet recently, subsequently disclosed to have been a photograph taken almost 30 years later, in 1977, in Germany. And the Germany photograph also has a quality of, it looks a lot closer to the camera, a lot closer to the ground.
That's a lot smaller, probably, in scale.
Yeah, and it's one of those, given the fame, you know, and again, the Trent photographs are another of one of those immediately recognizable images. They have been published and republished countless times. But we're getting kind of close to the end of the hour here.
We started a little late, but we can go until we feel comfortable stopping. It's my network. We'll do whatever the heck we want.
Attica. Sorry, I don't know where that came from.
Out of the mounds of babes? Wait, no. I would love to delve into some of these UFO cases more deeply. You know, anybody who knows me knows that I used to be that UFO guy instead of that wacky conspiracy guy.
It's those big dark eyes of yours, Miles.
They look like saucers.
I think it's more the fact that you appear to have no iris and no corneas, just one huge black iris.
It's the oil, man. It's the black oil.
No, please. Not another X-Files reference. What you were about to say and what I commented on talking about the show before we went on the air was that I consider especially the Heflin photographs in light of the new analysis that's been performed upon them a good buttress for the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And the reason I say that, and we can probably take this up next week, is because in spite of there being a tremendous body of literature out there, I simply do not believe we have the level of technology that makes these things possible.
Even though part of the article, or rather part of this essay, talks about James McDonald trying, he was vexed by this ring, this fourth photograph from the Heflin series, and investigated a military base sighting and photograph of an anomalous ring, and he uncovered a news report of the time, this is the 50s, about scientists on that base supposedly using ionizing radiation and certain types of gases that were creating luminous plasmas, for lack of a better word, of various shapes, because the scientist was supposedly trying to recreate UFOs. So, okay, you know, and how long have we had remotely piloted vehicles of a circular shape that may just use something more less exotic than plasma-generating ring leftovers as just some kind of ducted fan? But what if they were experimenting with some nuclear stuff, though? I guess it's really probably too small at that stage in the game. But I was just going to say, extraterrestrial, why invoke extraterrestrial when I think you've invoked the ultra-terrestrial, or as some are now calling it, the crypto-terrestrial concept? That, you know, what the hell tells you that it's from any place other than Earth when, you know, these things have been sighted throughout human history? And that would be my question. We'll talk about this more later. But I got to end with this weird synchronicity. I found on the Anomalist earlier today their headline, Kevin Randall's Roswell, quote-unquote, UFO, unquote, evidence to get audited, from criticalthinkers.org, which is actually Cal Korf's site. Sheikh Khalid Mohammed has hired the firm of KPMG to begin an immediate forensic audit and investigation of UFO researcher Kevin Randall's numerous claims and writings about the purported Roswell UFO crash of 1947. And the article, the links go to Cal Korf's site, which is called criticalthinkers.org, but it's basically it's also Cal Korf, where is it? It's calkorf.com, and that's with two F's. His initials literally are KKK. Now, I don't know that much about Cal Korf. I believe he's considered a skeptic about certain things, obviously, but I believe he's an endorser of Billy Meyer's Pleiadian beam ships. But I could be mistaken. He maybe is a skeptic on that case. But whatever the case, I've heard a lot from people that I kind of respect that he tends to exaggerate his back and makes references to his belonging to agencies that nobody can prove the existence of, whereas the people he criticizes and accuses of being frauds can clearly prove they did the things they claim they did. Kevin Randall is a military guy who his ideas about UFOs have spanned the gamut from debunking certain UFO things to endorsing other UFO things. He recently was called back up into service and served in Iraq. And, you know, generally seems to be an honest guy. And here comes Cal Korf, who says that Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, who I'm sure that's a really common name, but he referred at the press release at Cal Korf's site about this audit, it says that Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, the Gulf millionaire playboy, who is one of the financial backers behind the new reality-based TV series Secret Wars, which is apparently all about Cal Korf, has hired the firm of KPMG to begin an immediate audit. Now, KPMG in Israel, you can actually look that group up. So they actually exist, and maybe they really have a guy who happens to also be called Sheikh Khalid Mohammed. But the synchronicity here, I can't believe this. It's like this press release was issued 2 days ago, and what's on the news wires today? All the news wires are filled with the confession of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. You know that guy that they've claimed was behind the 9/11 attacks?
Yes, from A to Z.
And this guy, he apparently killed Lincoln. you know,
he looks good for a guy 170 plus years old.
Well, here's a young picture of him.
Oh.
Supposedly, but if you look online,
doesn't look like a daguerreotype.
Doesn't look like him at all, if you ask me. But there's other pictures of him that are the more common ones. But this is a whole weirdness in and of itself. But the photos that they put out there of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed really look different to me. But whatever. Anyway, I just wanted to end with this weird April Fool's joke. Is it April 1st yet?
In some continuum. I'm just trying to figure out the Green Lantern reference in the picture on the left there.
That's an image that was created by one of Cal Korf's nemesis, Paul Kimball, who is a nice new upstart in the UFO community, whose blog is redstarfilms.blogspot.com. You can look up the title of his blog is The Other Side of Truth.
Yes, I've seen it referenced on The Anomalous.
He's doing some great videography in the field of ufology and had his own UFO Frontier Sciences Conference in Halifax, Nova Scotia, I believe. And anyway, he was on the receiving end of a lot of Cal Korf's criticisms, and so he came up with that image.
I'm looking below Captain Cal Korf of the Israeli secret super service something. Scroll back down a little bit.
Yeah, basically.
Yes. Chronicles the real life activities of Captain Cal Korf of the Israeli founded Special Secret Services.
Yeah.
S3.
Which nobody can verify. So good old Cal, he's super secret. Anyway, that's it for tonight's show. Thanks for joining us. We really appreciate your tuning in and listening. And if you're downloading the podcast, that's great. You can always go to precognitivedissonance.podomatic.com. And we have a new blog. There's nothing there yet, really, but precognitivedissonance.com, where you'll be able to tune in to, well, you'll be able to listen to past episodes and find out more about the show. So, again, thank you all for tuning in, and
stay tuned. I'll be back on in just a few minutes to read the closing pages of a chapter from Oddities, a Collection of Strange Facts by Rupert T. Gold on the Moving Coffins of Barbados, and hopefully starting a chapter on the Berberlands of Cayman Sue.
Cool. Stay tuned.
Vampires, dude.